Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I'm thrilled to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, Paul Schrader is being muzzled by Focus Features. The legendary Oscar-nominated writer-director of First Reformed and the writer of Taxi Driver has been asked to zip it by Focus Features, the distributor of his latest movie, The Card Counter. That film, starring Oscar Isaac, hopes to be an Oscar contender, meaning the stakes are quite high beyond the normal millions of dollars at the box office. This is why Focus has ordered Schrader to stay off Facebook for the foreseeable future. Yes, his posts there have flown a bit under the radar because, well, it's Facebook and not Twitter, and that's where most journalists and cancel culture enthusiasts spend their days. But, you know, better safe than sorry. Here's what Schrader had to say. Quote, got a message from Focus, who is releasing Card Counter, to back away from social media because anyone can get offended with or without reason by anything you might say. It's their sport. The only message that is offense-proof is silence, so goodbye for now, end quote. On the one hand, I kind of get it. Here's Schrader's last post, for instance, in all caps, quote, in your mind, who are the three hottest, most talented Asian, parentheses, Japanese, Chinese, Korean, in that order, end parentheses, actresses age 30 to 35 now working, end quote. And a couple of days before that, he wrote, quote, I thought history was written by the winners, not the whiners, end quote. You know, this is where you can see how he earns the big bucks as a movie writer. But Schrader is kind of wrong here, actually. The whiners do actually get to write the current history, and that's why Focus is so scared, which again, I get it. But I'm also frankly kind of disgusted by their complete willingness to, their complete unwillingness to stand by an artist because he sometimes posts slightly risque things on Facebook. I mean, we're talking here about the guy who made Hardcore and wrote transcendental style in film Ozubre Son and Dryer. He's a little bit esoteric in his choice of posting topics. He's a real poster, folks. He's a poster. But, you know, of course, in this day and age, we all have to clutch our pearls about it. The issue here is not so much why doesn't Focus want to defend any of these things? It's more that they're not just willing to say, who cares what he posts on Facebook? The movie we're releasing is the only thing that matters to us, and leave it at that. Alyssa, given the incredible volume of controversial posts by Schrader that are already out there anyway, is there any real positive to Focus doing this now?
What's sort of amazing to me about this is it's not as if the change in sort of national or at least very online Twitter film people mood is new, right? And so it is bizarre to me, even if this project started shooting 5 years ago, I don't understand how studios at this point don't have detailed social media clauses written into the contracts of everyone they go into business with, right? Like, it's not like it's hard to find out who Paul Schrader is or sort of how his brain works or what he's interested in. And that's true of basically anyone who works in any creative industry today. So however there not been sort of internal company deliberations about what works for the company and what doesn't and how they want folks to approach social media? I just, you know, for an industry that specializes in sort of messaging and speaking to the public, they're all just astonishingly bad at thinking through how any of this would work. And maybe that just reflects an anxiety about the fact that this is an industry that has been totally transformed by social media, where the notion of celebrity has been totally transformed by social media, and folks are sort of reluctant to acknowledge that, you know, a random influencer can sell as many units of whatever product as Jennifer Aniston can sell Smartwater. But like, how do you not sit down and think through what you want social media policies to be as part of your contractual agreements with people to whom you're giving millions of dollars to make projects? It just, anything that the studios do sort of retroactively like this strikes me as such incredible corporate ass covering that I have a hard time taking any of it seriously.
Yeah, and part of the issue here is that, so The Card Counter is an independent feature. It was, you know, it was financed and produced outside of Focus. Focus picked it up to distribute it. So, like, I would guess they didn't really have much to say while he was making it. But this movie's been attached to Focus for, I don't know, the better part of a year now. And he has been posting this whole time.
It's not like this was something that, you know, it's not like this is like The Irishman, right? Like the financiers for The Irishman being like, oh, we suddenly, like a billion years into this process, don't like what Martin Scorsese is saying about whatever on Twitter, right? Like, if
he's wrong about the Marvel movies,
you sign-
we can't have that stirred up controversy about superheroes. Right.
But this is, I mean, if this is a distribution contract that was signed a year ago, like, the internet and the way people behave on it and react to it is not substantially different now than it was a year ago, except for the fact that some of the things that drive people bananas are different. Like, just if you care about this, write it into the contracts. Like, just do it in advance. And also, like, an intern with Google could have gone on the internet and been like, you know, this Paul Schrader guy has some kind of wild stuff on Facebook. Like, what do we think about that, right? Like, this is so easy that the inability of companies to do this or think about it in advance is just such an industry-wide embarrassment. It's
ridiculous. So I think it's actually difficult to figure out how to write this into contracts, except to say you can't use social media unless you are promoting the film in a very conventional way, right? There's not, because there is, I mean, it's terrible, but it's completely true that the piece of advice he was given here, which was, we don't know what's going to offend people. We literally have no idea. It could be literally anything. And so there's not like there's not a way to write a contract that says you can't post anything offensive. And here's all the lists, right? There's not a list of offensive terms.
That's
as you said,
true,
a year ago, the list would be different. And if they signed it a year ago, right? So it sort of seems to me that if they ended up doing this contractually, then the rule would be social media is exclusively for generic promotional statements of the sort that you would give at a studio junket. And nothing else. And that might be an okay rule, but the rule would be pretty stifling and pretty muzzling. Now, I'm not opposed to corporations saying, look, that's the terms of working with us. You get our money and we require you to basically turn your social media accounts into promotional accounts for the work that we are funding. But that's what they would have to do.
There's an interim step. I mean, you could ask for, you know, an hour's notice before you post anything. Like, you could do stuff that would at least give your publicity department like a chance to be like, well, Paul Schrader's going to be at it again in 2 hours. Like,
who wants to be the account manager for Paul Schrader's shitposting, though, right? And like, that's a weird and difficult job, because I'm sure if he's saying this stuff online and if he's posting that he's getting this feedback, he just doesn't seem like a super easygoing guy about this sort of thing. And you end up in the situation that I recall reading a story, and I could be getting a bunch of details wrong here, so let's not take this as journalistic fact, but there was,
it was anyway.
Something like, when Hillary Clinton was running for president, every time she tweeted, it had to go through 27 staffers or something like that, right? And it was, I could be, the number was wrong, and I'm pretty sure it was Hillary Clinton, though. And if you're going to be vetting every single thing that Paul Schrader says on Facebook or Twitter, then you end up having to have that kind of process in place for every artist who might be saying something. Wait, is this person going to be offending this group today? What are the rules? Anyway,
okay. Alyssa, can I just clarify one thing? Are you saying that Paul Schrader should run his tweets by the Focus publicity department ahead of time, or Facebook posts through the Focus publicity department ahead of time, or that he should just ping them and be like, "Hey, I'm going to post something"?
I was going to say the former. Like, at least, I mean, don't screw over your press people, right? So it's like they have an hour to be like, "Well, Paul Schrader's going to be at it again about the Asians," like, so they can. I mean, I think that's sort of an interim space that's maybe a courtesy thing, right? It's like, look, we will let you shitpost all you want, but at least, like, do our PR folks the favor of, like, being able to just know what's coming so nobody's surprised, right? Like,
I mean, again, I would just counter all of this by saying, wouldn't a better rule be for Focus to say, it doesn't matter what he puts on Facebook, we're not the boss of his Facebook account. We have nothing to do with that. And none of you people should care. You should care about this movie that we're putting out. This is the thing. And, you know, people who are going to get all hot and bothered and start grabbing their pearls.
This guy's
say,
allowed
no,
to say whatever he wants on social media while also making a movie. Good luck with that policy, Sonny. What?
I mean, I would argue it's like
the, it should be the policy. This should be the policy.
I would argue that what I'm suggesting is not so much a matter of like vetting or of even of putting focus in the position of having to sort of decide what it's going to defend and what it's not. It's just sort of a professional courtesy, right? It's like, look, yes, the world is such that people will get mad no matter what you say. And you should see some of the pitches that end up in my inbox. People can find ways to be mad about everything. But, you know, I try as a general rule, because like I try to be a polite person, you know, if I am going to write something that's going to cause a lot of blowback on the internet or that might be, you know, get my editors, you know, like a bunch of letters, like I try to let people know because I'm a decent human being and I'm someone who, unlike Paul Schrader, is actually paid for my political opinions. But, you know, I don't want anyone to be surprised or feel screwed over either personally or professionally. And there is a world in which you can ask people like, hey, you're artists. We respect your vision. All we ask is that you don't surprise us.
So, Alyssa, you are a decent and courteous person who treats your colleagues with respect. But one difference here is that they are your staff colleagues who you have an ongoing relationship with, right? You're a staff editor, right? Columnist. Apologies if you are a staffer at the Washington Post opinion section. And yes. Paul Schrader is not a staffer with these organizations. He is taking their money for projects. And so I think the question here to me is, when you buy a Paul Schrader film, if you are a distributor or if you are a backer of the production, you know, what is it that you're buying? Are you buying just that script and then the output of 30 days or 17 days of filming and whatever gets edited out of that, right? Like, is that what you're buying? Or are you buying Paul Schrader, the media persona, for some period of time? And I think those are questions that can be solved through contracts, right? But what we've not done so far is, for the most part, solve those things through contracts. Now, look, it's not uncommon. I mean, it's going back decades for stars and for directors, for big name talent, to have morals clauses, to have kind of PR clauses. You can't disparage the work, that sort of thing. But now in the age where everybody has access to a huge megaphone all the time, it's become more complicated because these things have become more expansive. And I just think that eventually, Alyssa, I think you're kind of right that this sort of thing can be solved through contractual negotiation. I just think
decent professional norms.
Yes, to some extent, professional norms, but professional norms are just going to be really hard to navigate amongst a very difficult group of people. Like, Paul Schrader just seems like I love his movies. He does not seem like somebody who's like really just gentle and collegial. And I think that's how he makes great movies. But there's just going to be like a lot of really big personalities. And these people are not going to, you call them collegial norms. And I agree, those are important. They work really well when you have colleagues. But in the film industry, a lot of this is one-off kind of contractual work. And, you know, it's not normal, for example, for, I don't know the Washington Post policy, but it's not normal for organizations that are, say, paying a freelancer for a one-off piece to have a complicated social media policy around that piece. Now, a good freelancer might say, hey, editor, I got this feedback, or I'm going to tweet this, and you might sort of, and that would be a good way to have a good relationship with your editor, right? That would be a reasonable thing to do, but it's not done normally because that is a big extra layer of management and administration and sort of thinking about like, oh, we're not just getting this 900 word op-ed from this person, we're also, in some sense, buying and taking some amount of responsibility for everything they tweet or post on Facebook or TikTok or Instagram for whatever period of time. Is it forever? Is it a month? Is it, right? And like these questions just sort of, I don't think it's super obvious how to figure out how to navigate this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I don't feel responsible for everything every freelancer I work with says on the internet. That said, I mean, if I know that someone has a reputation for being really sort of mercurial or indiscreet on social media, I'll probably be less inclined to work with them. And I also just want to say, I mean, I think there is, Hollywood has really thrived under an, Hollywood has long made excuses for the idea that there shouldn't be sort of professional norms or accepted standards of decency because people are creative and need freedom, not just to pursue sort of ideas and their vision, but to be sort of free from social constraints and norms. And that has had some really devastating consequences for the industry. And I don't, you know, I mean, I'm not saying Paul Schrader being an idiot on Facebook is even remotely morally equivalent to everything Harvey Weinstein did. But I think it is always worth, you know, just doing a little bit of an emotional check-in and saying, like, is being an asshole really necessary to the work? Is being unprofessional really necessary to the work? And I would argue that in long-term collaborative freelance situations like movie making, collegiality is actually even more important than it is in established employment relationships, because these are contingent relationships. They are not built on long-term trust and understanding of other people. They involve a lot of people who are quite vulnerable, in fact. And to a certain extent, you know, given those, you know, necessary elements to the work, the standards for being a decent human being should actually be higher, because there is less room, you know, there are fewer formal HR processes, there are, you know, there is less room for sort of nuance and understanding someone's tone over time. There is less of a long-term commitment to each other. And so the standards actually should be higher.
I agree with that to a certain extent, but I do feel like we are almost talking past each other just a little bit here, because again, I do not think Paul Schrader's Facebook post should be considered in under the scope of the work, right? That I don't think that we benefit as a society from asking every corporation to be on the hook for everything that every person that works for them puts out on social media. I just think that's that's an unhealthy way to live. And like, and it's different. I understand that it's different because Paul Schrader, you know, this could be an Oscar contending movie, which brings a whole different level of scrutiny, et cetera, et cetera. But I really just think that we would be better off as a society for having a pretty strict separation between these two worlds of saying, like, what a guy does on his personal time in his own personal space is one thing. And if he's like on the set of the movie saying, hey, who are the hottest Asian chicks? Somebody get me a list of hot Asian broads. I need them right now. Like, I that would be different. That's a different issue. That would be a different thing.
How about as entirely a compromise, but like, we shut down Twitter and Facebook?
Yes, finally, we don't need to shut them down. That's the solution
to get off of them. No, so I actually
figure out what's going on.
That in some sense, when a studio or distributor or backer of some sort says, "Look, dude, you have to quiet down on the social medias," what they are doing is attempting to defend the art, right? Not. Like, what they're trying to do is make sure that that's what people pay attention to. And there is, you know, in some sense, I think they own Paul Schrader's political opinions, whether they want to or not, because nobody would care about them if he wasn't Paul Schrader, the guy who gets millions of dollars every couple of years to make movies. And the people who give him those millions of dollars have every right, if they want to. They don't. I'm certainly not saying it's mandatory or that they even should. But if they want to say, look, our millions for your script and your direction are contingent on you staying the heck off of Facebook, then that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. And look, there's some wisdom in staying off of social media. And also, as much as I think, like, Paul Schrader should be allowed to say stuff on social media and we shouldn't worry about it too much, he makes movies for a living. He gets millions of dollars. I mean, even a small budget film is a seven-figure investment for the most part. Does he really need to spout off his political opinions on Facebook as well? Like, that is in some sense, he is free riding on the millions of dollars that people have invested in his movies, because if he wasn't Paul Schrader, movie maker, then nobody would care what he was saying on Facebook.
if he wasn't Paul Schrader movie maker, he wouldn't be able to make the movies. I mean, again, it's like it's not like he was on Facebook in the 1970s and 80s when he was making the Taxi Driver and Hardcore.
Maybe he was like, working with the Time Variance Authority. It's possible.
Stop mentioning the Time Variance Authority. You have to knock that off. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Focus Features has silenced the great Paul Schrader? Peter?
It's controversial.
Alyssa? It is both a controversy that he's on Facebook at all. Get off Facebook, Paul Schrader. You're better than that. And it's a controversy that Focus is silencing him. If the great Paul Schrader wants to be on Facebook being a crazy old man, he should be allowed to do it. Go Paul Schrader. All right. If you enjoy the show, and who doesn't, it's great. Make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we'll have a bonus members-only episode about dad movies, or movies about dads, or maybe great movie dads, something along those lines anyway, all to celebrate Father's Day. And we went a little bit long on controversies and non-controversies because the main event, I think, is going to be a little bit short today. The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. Every once in a while, I like to review a sequel to a movie I haven't seen just to see how high the concept actually is. For instance, in a movie like this, the only thing I should really need to know going into it is the title. This is a movie about a man who is bodyguarding the wife of a hitman. Yes? Well, no, actually. There's a scene where he does play her bodyguard, but it's a ruse. It's just a ruse. Really, the wife, who is played by Salma Hayek, has shanghaied the bodyguard, Ryan Reynolds, to rescue the hitman, Samuel L. Jackson, from the Italian mafia, notably not mentioned in the title. And that's just part of their misadventures. The Greek tycoon played by Antonio Banderas wants to destroy the European infrastructure as revenge for the EU's punitive policies towards Greece, an incredible pre-pandemic subplot that has aged remarkably well in the shutdown interregnum we've all lived through. To stop him, Interpol agent Frank Grillo must get the titular trio to take him down. On the one hand, this movie is not very good. I'd be lying if I said I didn't occasionally chuckle. Ryan Reynolds, there's this one very funny part where Ryan Reynolds does this pantomime that I won't spoil for the listeners, just in the off chance that you go see this movie.
Don't go see this movie.
While Samuel L. Jackson is on the phone. And I find Ryan Reynolds deeply amusing. And you'll notice I didn't name any characters here because really we're all going to see this for Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson and Salma Hayek and Antonio Banderas. This is a high concept, star driven movie, but it is sadly on the whole not very funny. And the action is, again, on the whole, not that exciting. Lots of CGI explosions, just kind of looking fake all over the place. Movie theaters need this sort of high concept programmer to work as filler between the tent poles. So it's a bad sign that this pulled in a pretty disappointing B from CinemaScore and a relatively soft $11.7 million 3-day weekend, although the 5-day numbers are slightly better at $17 million, but like still not great. It's going to do okay, I guess. It's not going to be a big hit. That said, on the other hand, it is better than In the Heights, right, Peter?
In fact, when Alyssa and I walked out of this movie, the first thing I asked Alyssa was, do you think Sonny would rather watch this or In the Heights?
Oh, this a million times. This 10 times out of 10.
I would definitely rather watch In the Heights, or at least a condensed version of it. This movie was so bad. I admit I chuckled maybe once or twice, like sort of involuntarily, in the way that like you laugh when somebody's like trying so hard and eventually you're like, okay, here's a pity laugh. But that's all this movie deserves is pity, because this movie manages to be both incredibly lazy. Like there's not any kind of inventive gags or anything that's clever or particularly interesting about it. And also trying way too hard. So at every moment, this movie kind of knows that it's not working and assumes that you're bored, and then just tags every scene with some sort of interruption, some sort of like scream fest, like a very lazy, you know, sort of like, oh, here's a clever insult back and forth, right? And at no point does it ever actually sort of connect and engage at all. I just wanted to get up and leave throughout this entire movie. And I like bad action movies. I mean, I'm the kind of person who at 1 a.m., if I cannot sleep, what I do is I turn on bad action movies intentionally. Like if I don't want to watch something good, I want to watch at most something of like Patrick Swayze Roadhouse quality, which is a very good bad movie. But like really, I want to watch something much worse than that. I want to watch like a Paul W.S. Anderson Mortal Kombat movie, right? And so this is the sort of movie that in theory I kind of like, oh, I can appreciate its charms. No, it's not charming at all. This is the move. This is a movie that is aggressively, like, just unappealing in every way. And I like the actors. I like this sort of vibe. There's just not much to it. None of the action scenes are remotely engaging or interesting. Can you remember like
terrible.
A great shot
or
something that happens? Like there's one scene where like some dudes are kind of dressed the same or something, like they're shooting. I don't like, but it's just that like, that's the only thing I could describe. I saw this movie yesterday and that is the only thing I can describe to you about the action. Is there even a line or exchange that stands out in your memory? This movie is just so indistinct and unmemorable. It is one of the worst things I have seen in a very, very long time.
Had you seen the original?
No, I hadn't,
you hadn't seen,
the original
seen the original.
Because
had
I got the same vibe
the
from the
yeah.
original. Which
the original
was that it was
also looked kind of terrible.
And it's the same director. And I got the vibe from the original was that it was a completely disposable movie. And this is the most disposable, least necessary film I can imagine.
Yeah. Alyssa, I assume you loved it.
I think the only thing that I loved about it is that it proves that cancel culture is still limited in its power. Because part of what's fascinating about this movie is it feels like something that was made in the late 90s. Just like Selma Hayek's entire character is like, I'm Mexican and baby crazy. Like there's literally a line about like how Mexican she sounds at one point. Like, and extremely violent.
Well, because she was supposed to be play acting as a British person in, for whatever reason, in that club scene, which again, I could not describe the preceding events or the events that followed it because nothing in this movie seems to follow from any event or that happens, right?
Yeah.
Don't forget also that she's hot. That's the
yes.
other thing that
yes.
we have
there
to
is,
remember
there,
that she
there
has
is a scene where
a,
she like strips down to a long line bra to like distract a bunch of henchmen and it's effective, right? Like, I mean, it is the kind of thing that's like, I just sort of sat there and was like, this is amazing. Like, you know, theoretically, you know, everything's PC now and you can't say stuff. And yet this movie, and in particular, Hayek's character in this movie exists and was funded, you know, at like millions of dollars and is being
Tens
released in
of
theaters. And like,
dollars.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's so awful. And it's not even like engagingly awful, right? Like, I am pregnant and have to get up and go to the bathroom a lot in the middle of screenings. And this is a movie where I just felt like I missed absolutely nothing every time I did that. Like, it was like an opportunity to leave. It was great. And that's basically my feeling about this movie is like, it was just wonderful to have an excuse to leave like three times in the middle of the screen.
So did you guys notice that Gary Oldman is in this film? He's credited.
Well, he was the villain in the first one. I don't think he actually has any scenes in
He's credited in the cast list somehow or another.
Yeah, he's credited on IMDb, but he definitely was not in the movie in any significant way.
Yeah.
No, it's a bad movie. It's a bad, like, this is the thing, is that it is just a bad, bad movie. And I like all of these people. I like Ryan Reynolds, who has a tendency to, like, pick bad movies and can still sometimes be pretty good in them. I can't remember if you guys like Six Underground or not, but I remember enjoying that quite a bit, mostly again for him.
That's a much more enjoyable bad movie because even though it's pretty terrible, there's something going on and there's an attempt to actually engage the viewer that I won't say it works, but it seems like there's actually like it's Michael Bay doing like weird magnet stuff. And
yeah,
I'm okay with that.
This movie is sort of like it's like aggressively and insultingly stupid, right? I mean, the whole plot is theoretically kicked off by, you know, crippling EU sanctions on Greece. First, Greece's economy has always been sort of catastrophic and terrible. Second, Greece is an EU member country, right? Like, and I realize this is not the sort of thing that most people watching this movie are going to think or care about, but it shows just like such a basic lack of interest in anything, right? I mean, it literally reads like a script where someone was like, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to like cut myself off from the world for a year. I'm going to like ban myself the use of Google. I'm deliberately not going to check everything. And I'm just going to like write whatever comes into my head. Right? Like it feels like the product of an almost deliberate sloppiness, right? And there are opportunities for it to be funny, right? Like they go to the Italian villa and, you know, you're about to meet Ryan Reynolds' character's dad, who's supposed to be this legendary bodyguard. And the obvious joke should be that it's Kevin Costner, right? Like it should
because
be like
because of the movie The Bodyguard. The Bodyguard. Yeah.
And then it's Morgan Freeman, which they do for some reason. Like, for some
it's funny reason, because he's black.
But
that's the level of humor that this movie is operating on. Yes. I mean, I'm being sarcastic here, people. I'm not explaining why it's funny. I'm just saying that like the whole joke is predicated on Samuel L. Jackson saying like he's black and you're white. And then and then it like is explained away with he's my stepdad. Like it's the worst. It's just the worst.
Yeah.
I really was upset that this movie was built around the main character's desire to get his occupational license back. And occupational licensing is bad for casket makers when it stops monks from making caskets. And it's also bad for hitmen. And he should. And like the best part of the movie was when Samuel L. Jackson was like, hey, man, it's okay that you don't have an occupational license to be a hitman. You should be like, I can't remember exactly what the line, but it was like, I don't give an F that I don't have a license. And he had to like repeat it several times. And finally he did it, yelled it. He was happy with himself, who he was without a certificate from an occupational licensing body. And then at the end he gets his license back. And it's like, you've sold out everything that was good about this movie. The one thing that I liked was that it was about how people can do jobs without professional licensing.
Yeah. I would say that is like, again, it's kind of a funny idea. There's a kernel of an idea there, except, and I wasn't 100% sure if this was something I had missed by not seeing the first one, if there's a whole explanation about who is doing the regulating of the bodyguard industry, if this is like, if you're cast out by this private organization, does the government like arrest you if you try to bodyguard? It wasn't 100% clear to me what was going on there. But again, this might be my own fault for not having seen the original. I don't know, guys.
I mean, it's also, they have like Frank Grillo playing this Interpol agent who's like really upset that he's not back in Boston. And the joke that they make that's like, he misses Boston is like, they don't have Sam Adams in the bars in Europe, right? Like, you can't even like make him have a bad Boston accent or like wear a Red Sox cap or something. Like, I mean,
that's
it's just
the main
so
thing
lazy
that Boston cops care about is Sam Adams in the bars.
I do wonder how much Sam Adams paid for that. To 2 years ago,
I've got to drink Peroni.
We're gonna have this cop from Boston. He's gonna like Sam Adams. You want to give us like $100,000 for that? Sure. Why not?
Again, that would have been funny if they'd had him drinking a Negroni or like a spritz of, right? Like if they'd had him drinking sort of weird traditional European drinks, and it's just a throwaway because Sam Adams, Boston.
If this had been a movie that was both about the evil to occupational licensing and about like weird Italian, like, spirits, this would have been Peter's favorite movie.
Yeah, that's correct. Even if it had been terrible,
it is the whole Frank Grillo subplot. It feels like weirdly tacked on because it's clear that at some point they were like, okay, how do we get them to the Greek tycoons whose name is Aristotle? How do we get them all to Aristotle's house? How do we make that happen? And they were like, Interpol. Sure.
Darts.
Why not?
Darts.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the hitman's wife's bodyguard? Peter.
You're going to be surprised, but I hated this movie. Thumbs down.
Alyssa.
This movie was so bad that it made me wish that cities would reimpose occupancy limits on theaters so fewer people would be able to see this.
Thumbs down. It's a bad movie, sadly. I did laugh once or twice, which is probably says more about me than the movie itself. All right, that is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on dad movies. And make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.